Good to be here. First, I want to. I was in Philadelphia over Shabbos, so that was arranged by one of our listeners. I don't know if he wants me to mention him by name, so let me just say thank you very much. It was a wonderful Shabbos, and there were other listeners to our the shows in Philadelphia at a great shul, the Marian Shtiebel, I think that's the official name, with a great rabbi, Dayan, Rabbi Itamar Rosenzweig. Rabbi Dr. Itamar, actually Rabbi Dr. Itamar Rosenzweig. He has two PhDs, if you can believe that. So that was very nice. Now, before we start, I want to get to one of you asked me a question already last semester. So I want to pull something up here because of what you asked, and then enlarge this. Okay, so we're dealing with Mussar. Obviously, Mussar, part of Mussar is to make you a more sensitive person, a better person, one who takes others' feelings into account. That's not all that Mussar is, but that's an important component. One who is, just a bad person and not a friendly person, we would not say that's a Mussar personality. In fact, there are some private letters from Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg where he reflects on this, that this person is supposed to study Mussar, and he's not a walking Mussar safer like Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. So the question asked me is Avos, chapter 2, where it says, Mishnah 10, that the sages said three things. We know this, let the honor of your friend be as dear to you as your own. That's obviously a very good Mussar statement. Do not be easily provoked to anger. Also, great Mussar, repent one day before your death. Also makes sense because basically you don't know when you're going to die. So every day you should repent. That's at least how I interpret it. I know Rabbi Kelman's an expert in Avos. He might have different ways to interpret it, but I'll be curious what he's going to say at the end about this one. He also said, warm yourself before the fire of the wise, but beware of being singed by their glowing coals, for their bite is the bite of a fox, and their sting is the sting of a scorpion. And their hiss is the hiss of a serpent, and all their words are like coals of fire. So I was asked, is this how we're supposed to, the sages? If a sage is a Mussar personality, we're supposed to be worried about their bite and their sting. And what I want to say is that I give you a better source, even a more problematic source in Yoma 23a. What does Rabbi Yochanan say? Kol Tamid Chacham, Kol Tamid Chacham, any Torah scholar who does not avenge himself and bear a grudge like a snake when insulted is not considered a Torah scholar at all. And then the commentary here says it's important to uphold the honor of the Torah. So again, what type is this? What we want from our sages to bear grudges and avenge themselves? I mean, the Gemara itself then goes on and says, are you really supposed to bear a grudge? And they explain what a grudge is. They say, well, why should you do this? Don't we know that we're supposed to be, ne'elavim ve'nemolvim? We're supposed to be insulted, but not insult. So how are these sages supposed to have this attitude? And the Gemara responds that the prohibition against taking vengeance and bearing a grudge applies to cases of personal anguish. However, actually, the scholar may keep resentment in his heart. He shouldn't act on it. And then they ask, well, didn't Rava say that if you forego your reckonings with others for injustices done to him, then the heavenly court will also forego the punishment? And the Gemara says, even a scholar who is insulted must forgive insults, but that's only in cases where his antagonist has sought to appease him. And in those cases, he allows himself to be appeased. But if no apology has been offered, the scholar should not forgive him. And that's when the scholar, all the things we say that his bite should be like a snake, etc. Hold on, stop sharing. Okay, so then what's going on here? Don't we assume that the great sages would be such that they wouldn't hold grudges, even if the person, I mean, we have old stories about Chafetz Chaim and people like that, where they didn't hold anything against someone, even if the person did a bad thing and he never apologized, never came to them. So it could be that all these sages that we know these stories, they would say, well, I'm not at that level. Remember, we're talking about the sages should act this way. They might say, I'm not at the level of the sage. And for me, it's best just to err on the side of safety and assume I'm not at that level. So I should forgive everyone, even if they don't deserve it. That's how I think they probably would answer, look, this is one of the, there's lots of statements in the Talmud that aren't necessarily followed. We saw that. But, and we actually admire the rabbis who, even if the person's a jerk and doesn't and insults the rabbi still, even if the guy never apologizes, the rabbi doesn't take revenge. So, okay. So, as to how they could say this, I mean, it's about the honor of the Torah, I think. And, but in, so I wouldn't get so overworked about what it, about what the Talmud says, as much as we know how the great rabbis acted. And they didn't, to my knowledge. I mean, some did, of course, we know about some, but the ones we know as tzaddikim, not just the ones as Talmidei Chachamim, are known to have overlooked all sorts of insults. And, now I want to mention one other thing though. You, a rabbi we've dealt with a good deal, Rav Yekusiel Yehuda Greenwald, Leopold Greenwald, Columbus, Ohio, says a really wild thing about this statement. He says, in his opinion, this statement, which I just read you from Chagiga, might apply also to Avos, he said that this is directed against Christianity. Christianity taught turn the other cheek, and because we don't believe in turning the other cheek, they added this position here so that shasavlanut yoter midai ubitulaye shivatel atam kulo. That is, what they're trying to tell us is that we shouldn't be like this, and that, yes, maybe there's some stories of rabbis who, but you're not supposed to let people step on you. And that's, he thinks that this was important to be stated in opposition to Christianity. He actually, interestingly, says, he gives another example also. He says, you know, there's another passage in Chagiga. It's talking about, this is Chagiga 15a, is talking about a woman who gets pregnant, and they say perhaps she washed in a bath that contained the man's semen from which she became impregnated while remaining a virgin. There's a case there, in the, and you know, there's this this medieval legend about Yirmiyahu. Oh no, is it there's a Ben Sira is comes from that way. Now there's other Gemaras or other rabbinic sources that don't assume this is possible at all. And the Rogatchover says it's impossible. So that means it's just like a theoretical discussion. But what Greenwald says is when the Gemara raises as a possibility that a woman could get pregnant in the bath, that's in order to make this a whole idea of virgin birth al pi ateva. So if some, so that Jews don't think that, you know, they see that the Jesus that, you know, marries a virgin, therefore it must be a miracle, it must be divine or anything like that. No, even if you're convinced she's a virgin, it doesn't matter. We know this could happen. That's what he says. It's a strange thing to say, but that's what he says. But I tell you, I'm reviewing right now the proofs, second set of proofs from my book on Rav Kook. And in there, I deal with the so-called Kuzari proof, that if enough people, if we believe it, and it has to be true because our forefathers wouldn't have lied to us. The truth is that the Kuzari never says this. If you look at it, Rav Sadia Gaon says something similar, but the Kuzari does not say that, even though it's called the Kuzari proof. And I don't think this proof has any validity whatsoever, although Rabbi David Gottlieb of Eshet Torah has tried to revive it. But I raise an issue there dealing with Toldos Yeshu. I don't know if I mentioned this before. We have this text, a medieval text. Well, it's actually not medieval. It goes back even to the Talmudic period that has Jesus doing all sorts of miracles. And you know how he does these miracles? He does these miracles with the Shem and the Farish, that he stole the God's holy name so he could fly and do various miracles. Well, and Jews believe this. They wrote this. Well, why do they believe this? Why don't they just say Jesus is a fraud? I think all of us listening don't believe that Jesus did any miracles. And I think the answer is that the stories in the New Testament are mentioned as having been viewed by thousands and thousands of people. So if thousands of people viewed it, then it must be true. It must have happened. Well, if it happened, then how could it have happened if we don't accept Jesus? It must have been through magic. And how does he do the magic? He does the magic through the Kabbalistic knowledge, Shem HaFarosh. Now, today, the fact that 1,000 people are recorded as having seen these miracles, that doesn't mean we believe it. Of course we don't believe it, 1,000 people. Who wrote it? One person wrote it. It's not like 1,000 people wrote it. One person wrote that thousands of people saw it. And by the way, this is, they're writing this only like 50 years before the miracles are supposed to have taken place. So people would have been alive and they would have been able to say, hey, wait a second. If you adopt the Kuzari argument, then Jesus must have done these miracles. Because how could someone say something when people in the audience could say, I was there, it never happened, etc. The answer is that's not how history works. People always write stories. People write stories about things in contemporary times. So that's how I explain the whole idea of toldosiation, that Jews believe this because they adopted the Kuzari type of argument. And how to explain it? Kabbalah. By the way, there are examples of Jews accepting Christians' miracles in the medieval period for the same reason. And what did they say? It was magic. It must have been magic. Why did they believe it? Again, because they were naive. They were gullible. They assumed if thousands and thousands of Christians report such a miracle, then it must have happened. And how could it happen? Christians can't do miracles. It must be from the dark side, magic, things like that. Okay, today we're going to focus, we're going to continue with what we're doing, the Musher dispute, and we'll do more with Slobodka and also Tells. Hopefully we'll get to Tells. I want to begin with Binyamin Brown's article in this volume I showed you, Yeshivot Uvate Midrashot, edited by Emmanuel Etkes, and it's called Gadrut Ha'adam Hakmanato, that, Gadrut Ha'adam, the altar Sabatka, and then he got smaller. In other words, because the successors of the altar, they didn't have his approach on these matters. But on page 248 and on, he calls attention to something really interesting, I think, that basically, the altar of Slobodka's approach was always a positive approach, always an approach of happiness, of joy. And he spoke about how everything you do is full of joy. Just like on Shabbos, for instance, we enjoy, we eat, we enjoy. He says that's the Shabbos completes creation and brings it to its ultimate kedusha. Therefore, he says, Shekol HaBriya, Shekedosha. And the whole creation, which is holy, is only expressed with Tanugim Gashmi. So here you have the altar giving a very optimistic, positive approach that everything in this world is supposed to be, we're supposed to enjoy this world. We're not supposed to be, beating our chests all the time and making ourselves feel bad. On the contrary, he goes on. In fact, he even says, and this is relevant to the season we're coming up, where we're in as well. Even tshuva, what are you supposed to do during tshuva? Let's say Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. Are you supposed to sit there and are you supposed to cry and are you supposed to get all upset? I think that's the traditional approach for that, but he says no. He says tshuva is about oneg. Sharei ikar ha-tshuva hi l'takena tapagam shepagam ha-adam b'kdusha. The main tshuva is to fix the pagam, the defect in the kedusha. And if the kedusha is an oneg, as it is, then what's the pagam in kedusha? It's taking away from the oneg. So you can only fix the tshuva, fix the pagam, with what he calls hashlamata oneg. So, this is not a time, with the proof he brings that Rosh Hashanah, for instance, is not a time for feeling sad and down. Rather, you're a creation of man. God has given you this wonderful opportunity to do tshuva, to repent of your ways. That's something to be very happy about. And let me show you something here from the book of Ezra. This is what the altar cites. Actually, book of Nehemiah. Well, Nehemiah and Ezra are really the same book. So chapter 8 in Nehemiah, it says, all the people gathered themselves together as one man into the broad place before the water gate. And they spoke unto Ezra to bring the book of the law of Moses. That is, the people want it. So what does it say? Pasuk Beis. Ezra brought the law, the Torah, before the congregation, both men and women, and all that could hear with understanding. So I think this is quite significant. I don't know what the people in Gerba or other places would say when they don't have the women in the shul, but the men and the women and everyone who could hear on the first day of the seventh month. So what's the first day of the seventh month? That's Rosh Hashanah. And it goes on to say that he read before them in the presence of the men and the women. Very nice. And then it goes on. It mentions people, by the way, look at Pasuk 7, Zion. It mentions Yeshua. That's Jesus's name right there, Yeshua. Yeshua is a shortened form of Joshua. In fact, we have Yeshua and Joshua, the same figure, elsewhere in Tanakh. And look at verse eight, and then it says, in verse 8, it says, they read in the book and the law of God distinctly, and they gave the sense and caused them to understand the reading. So also very interesting. They didn't just read from the Torah. They explained it to them. The reading goes together with the explanation. Okay, but why is he mentioning this, the altar? Because look at Pasuk 9. He says, Ezra says, this day is holy unto the Lord your God. Mourn not nor weep, for all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. He said to them, go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, and send portions unto him, etc. For this day is holy. Don't be grieved. So there we see it, that you're supposed to have a positive attitude, a happy attitude. That's what the altar says. Now, but that's not how traditionally repentance has been understood. And it's understood very differently. In fact, Musar literature, next class, I think, or the class after, I'll deal with an interesting shiloh. Can you learn Musar literature on Shabbos? I want to give you something that reflects the old Musar approach, Rav Ovadia Yosef. You can look in Yechav Adas, his responsa, volume 7, number 227. He deals with the fact, where is it? Can a mourner, an avel, learn Musar on Shabbos? And for the Altar Sabbatka, of course not. Not if it's a mutzer of Godless Adam, because there's nothing sad about that. On the contrary, that's inspiring. That gives you happiness. If you recognize that you are a creation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you can accomplish amazing things, and Kal Vachomer, everyone, Jew and non-Jew, and a Jew all the more so, can accomplish amazing things, this is inspiring. This should put a smile on your face. But the old Musar was about making you feel sad and putting you in a, you know, in a very depressed mood because look who you are. Can, you know, what have you, all the terrible things you've done. So Rav Ovadia says, he quotes other sources that, that it's, mutar lavel ayin besfarim that bring you to tshuva. Furthermore, I found that in Yabia Omer, in volume 2, Yoredeya number 26, he says the same thing, but he says that Sifrei Musar that go off into other areas and explain psukim that lead to simcha, then you can't do that. But classic Sifrei Musar, he says that you can learn it, but that's not Slobodka Musar. He goes on, Brown, and I mean, he explains how this differs really from Rav Yisrael Salanter, who based his Shitas HaMusar on what he calls Midas HaYira, Yiras HaOnesh, VaYisurim. That's the old Musar. That's even Rav Yisrael Salanter's Musar, that it's based on, there's going to be punishment. You're going to be called to account for this. Not based on Ahava, but the Saba of Sabotka, the altar, he says that you should come to Tshuva not, you know, thinking about onshim and yisurim, punishments and suffering, but rather, as like I said, recognition of the great gifts that God has given to us. So then the altar says, well, how do you explain the makos and mitzrayim and other punishments that we see that bring sinners to tshuva? And he says that that yisurim eina ela l'ksilim l'umos olam, that for fools and for the non-Jewish world, they need the punishments. But Lagaba Yisrael ain't Zoladercha V'yosam V'yidei Tshuva. But for us, the Jewish people who are gifted with the Torah, we should know that that's not the way. He then continues, for certain special people, they're at a different level, they can focus on Yisurim. But for the rest of us, that should not be our focus. Absolutely not. And that's the Altar Sabaka. But then he continues on how Rav Avram Grudzinski, he calls this chapter Yuridat Optimism. That Rav Avram Grudzinski, successor to Sabaka, had a very different view. And okay, he brings other opinions as well. Um, Okay, so while we spoke about the yeshivas, I think last class, hold on, let me get my, I mentioned that Slabodka emerges victorious, not everywhere, but many, many places. So, for instance, I'm going to give you sources now. By the way, even Volozhin. Volozhin also, the place that Reb Chaim refused to allow Mussar in, and the Netziv, even Volozhin would bring in a Mussar. What happened? Not the original Volozhin, when the next Volozhin opened up under Rafal Shapiro, who, by the way, had he really had very little influence on the students. But what happened was there was a man, Rav Avram Drushkovitz. He was appointed the Mashgiach in 1905. Now, the Mashgiach in Volozhin is to make sure the students are there and see if anyone's reading Haskalah literature. It's not to give Musar shmuzim. But and by the way, he didn't have much success in trying to get rid of the newspapers, and it was a problem. But in 1912, he wanted to change the culture of the yeshiva, and he instituted Musar. Study of Musar in the yeshiva. And this also created huge controversy. In fact, there was a 3-month strike in the Volozhin yeshiva in 1912. It's hard. I haven't been able to find out the exact details of what that meant. Often we know the strikes where we've had other strikes in the yeshivas where the students refused to go into the Beis Medrash. That is, we're going to talk about Telz in a little bit, and we had in other places where they went on strike. The students don't stop learning, but instead of going to the yeshiva, they go to different Batei Midrash, and they boycott the Rosh Yeshiva's shiurim. So I assume that's what it means, a strike. But 3 months. And by the way, they won. The students won because you can't have a yeshiva if you don't have any talmidim. So they had to get rid of the Musar. However, it was only temporary because let's see, in 1922, yes, the son of Rafal Shapiro, his Rav Yaakov Shapiro, he put in a mashgiach, and there was Musar. So, and at this time, there was no opposition. 1922, very different atmosphere than earlier. We'll talk about what atmosphere was like in the first decade and after of the 20th century. And by 1922, he takes over. In 1925, he institutes a Musar yeshiva. And even Volozhin as Musar Shmuzin, I don't know if the Netziv and Rav Chaim were turning over in their grave, but that's what it is. Now, what about the other yeshivas? The great yeshiva, Knesset Beis Yitzchak, which broke away from, well, I shouldn't, actually, they didn't break away. You remember the big machlokes in Slabodka, the Alter takes his students, what, I think 60 students, and he leaves. The yeshiva he started, he leaves it and says, I'm going to make another yeshiva. He should have fought for the yeshiva, really. It was his yeshiva. He could have kicked out those troublemakers. But no, he decided he's going to leave. And he set up his own yeshiva, and Knesset Beis Yitzchak, led by Rav, then afterwards was led by Rav Baruch Baer, at first by the Rav of Kovno, Rav Baruch Baer, Talmud Mufak, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, obviously anti-Musar. So it begins as an anti-Musar yeshiva. However, even Knesset Beis Yitzchak, let me tell you, I just want to get the dates here. He had. When the yeshiva was in exile, after during World War I, and after they went into exile, Kremenchug, it's called. He Rav Baruch Baer had a son-in-law, Rav Reuven Grozovsky. Okay, he would become a Ram, a Rosh Yeshiva, but he had his brother-in-law, actually, no, someone who married his, sorry, he married his sister-in-law named Naftali Zev. Forget what the relationship was, but he was appointed. Both of them were involved in the yeshiva, and he, Rav Natali Zev Leibowitz, was appointed. He started bringing Musar into the yeshiva, and I mean, this is a yeshiva which had no Musar whatsoever. But in the end, he brought Musar into the yeshiva as well, and so you have Musar in Knesset Beis Yitzchak as well. Yeah, he was a student of the Altar of Slabodka, but he became mishpacha to Reb Baruch Ber, so he was brought into the yeshiva. Okay, he says that one of the things he says that every ben yeshiva has to be mischazek to come to tefillah in the yeshiva to learn mussar, which is reishis chachma. So even that, the mussar, even the non-mussar yeshivas were changing. Oh, and what about Brisk? The great yeshiva Brisk, that to this day, I'm told, doesn't have mussar in Jerusalem, but in Brisk it actually had mussar. What can I tell you about it? Okay, this is after though Reb Chaim. After Reb Chaim is niftar, the yeshiva was set. Brisk yeshiva was established again after World War I, Moshe Kosokolovsky in 1919. And in 1928, he agrees to hire a mussar, a mashgiach of mussar. So even there was even mussar in Brisk. All these yeshivas recognized that mussar was valuable, especially in response to the winds of secularization. I'll give you some examples of this when we sum up. Did mussar emerge victorious? Absolutely. Was it 100% victorious? No, there's always going to be holdouts. You remember the story I told you that when Reb Chaim, when Reb Yitzchak Blazer comes to Volozhin, and Reb Chaim says to him that if you're sick, you need castor oil, but if you're not sick, it's bad for you. He says, we in Volozhin, mussar is like castor oil. We in Volozhin, we don't need it. In fact, it'll be bad for us. It'll remove us from what we're doing. For people who are sick, they need mussar. And then I told you, Reb Yitzchak of Weinberg, when Reb Yitzchak Blazer repeated the story, without mentioning Reb Chaim by name, I guess he said a certain Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Yitzchak Blazer, said, this has nothing to do with castor oil. It's not medicine. This is, mussar is basic for everyone. But this story, the castor oil, interestingly enough, it's mentioned, in the book, which unfortunately you can't get the book anymore. I bought it years ago from a university library, and obviously you can get it from different libraries, but I don't know why they don't reprint it. Shulamith Meiselman's book, The Soloveitchik Heritage. I'm wondering if maybe her son, the Rosh Yeshiva, is not so enamored by the book, so he doesn't want it to be reprinted. But it's a collector's item now, and you can't buy it. If anyone sees it, get it quickly. I've looked to get a copy for myself and I haven't been able to. In there, she uses the castor. She repeats this, which I assume is true, that she's not confusing it. She says, because we know that Reb Moshe never studied the Mora Nevuchim. Reb Chaim studied the Mora, the Guide of the Perplexed. Reb Moshe didn't. And she said that Reb Chaim used the castor oil parable to dissuade Reb Moshe, to tell Reb Moshe not to study the Mora Nevuchim, that the Guide of the Perplexed is for people who are sick. If you have problems, shilas, questions, then you need the Guide of the Perplexed. But if you don't have questions, not only don't you need it, but it'll be dangerous for you. And it's not just Reb Chaim who thinks that. That's a common view in the yeshiva world, because after all, what's it called? Mora Nevuchim. The Guide of the Perplexed. So certainly it's better not to be perplexed. So if you're not perplexed, if you have a good emunah, then you don't need that. But if you're perplexed, letzareinu, if unfortunately you're perplexed, well then you need like an emergency intervention. So therefore you should look at the Mora Nevuchim. But no, but as Rav Kafak points out in his introduction, when it says the Guide of the Perplexed, it's not like these people are in a It's bad that they're perplexed. No, it's good that they're perplexed, because they're perplexed about important matters. They've begun to investigate the important theological matters that anyone who wants to really reach the heights of intellectual knowledge of God and spirituality, they're connected by the Rambam, has to go. So you're going to be perplexed, and now the Rambam is giving you the answers to how to get out of your perplexity. I mean, in the Guide of the Perplexed, I think at that Rav Kafka himself actually says anyone who doesn't understand this should look at Guide Book 3, Chapter 54. That's where the Rambam has the famous parable of the palace. You have the people, everyone's trying to find, let's say, trying to find the gate in to see the king. So you're trying to find God, let's say. That's the parable. So some people are in the empty room. Other people are searching for the gate. In that story, it's the philosopher, the rabbi philosopher. He's the one who's with God. But the one who's just the Talmud Chacham, who's only learned Gemara, he's not in on the inside. He's still on the outside. So there you see the Rambam openly, explicitly identifying with the necessity of studying philosophy. So of course, if you're going to study philosophy, as everyone should, if they reach a certain level, if you're not at that level, then you don't. But it's a good thing to reach that level, and therefore you will have perplexities. It's natural because you're going to come across things in philosophy that appear to contradict the Torah, and therefore the Rambam is going to explain to you, and he will be a guide for your perplexities. And really, you don't even need the Mor Nevuchim for this. You can just look in the say Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, the first four chapters of the Mishnah Torah, Yesodei HaTorah, the fundamentals of the Torah, the most important things. Take a look what's in the first four after we're done the class tonight, or right now if you choose to. Take a look what's in the first four chapters of Yesodei HaTorah. You might be expecting the Rambam's going to speak about Ikarei Emunah and maybe Shabbos and all. Check out what's in there and you'll see it's philosophy and it's even science, and though it's what he calls a Dover Gadol. So again, explicit identification with the philosophy. So in case you're wondering, what are Reb Chaim? Reb Chaim isn't just saying this. It's like when the Lubavitcher Rebbe told people, don't go to college. You could take it seriously if you're a Chabadnik, because it's not like the Lubavitcher Rebbe is like these other Rebbes that simply say, Kafira, Kafira, and all that. The Lubavitcher Rebbe himself had been to university, and he was learned in secular matters, so he's telling you, don't do it. Although there were people he told to go to university. I knew someone in particular, a Baal Tshuva from Russia, that the Rebbe told him to go. But as a general rule, well, for his Hasidim, let's say, people who grew up in Crown Heights, unless you're like a special person with a different an interest, he said not to go, and he was able to use his authority as one who had been there. Reb Chaim learned the Mor Nevuchim. He knew the Mor Nevuchim very well. And that was his considered judgment. So how do I know that Reb Chaim knew it? I mean, if you ask me, the Rugged Shover, yes, the Rugged Shover knew it. The Rugged Shover wrote commentary or comments on the Mor Nevuchim. They were published by Rav Kasher. We have the text of the Mor Nevuchim that the Rugged Shover used, and we have all of his notes. In fact, the Rugged Shover used the Mor Nevuchim in his commentary on the Rambam, on the Mishnah Torah. But my source for this is none other than than the grandson of Reb Chaim Morener of Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. And some years ago, Rabbi Rechman from YU published the Rishimo Shiurim of the collected Shiurim on Tractate Sukkah. And if you look on page 258, he says as follows. It's fascinating. I don't know if the Rav repeats this anywhere else. That's why I'm citing it from here. I think in Halachic Man, he has that story with Reb Chaim and the sunset. I think there he maybe cites the Mor Nevuchim, but here this is very differently. He says, first of all, there's a klal gadol, an important principle for us, that you don't ask questions if you have a conflict between the Mor Nevuchim and the Mishnah Torah. You don't ask questions on it. And, well, why not? Because Reb Soloveitchik has this as a tradition from his grandfather, Reb Chaim. Okay, it's interesting. I discussed this with Professor Twersky, actually. I mean, he discussed it in class. We dealt with some contradictions. You could say, well, they have different audiences. But for example, a Kansipur, well, if the Mishnah Torah and the Mor Nevuchim have different reasons for chasing away the mother bird, and there's other contradictions as well. So I guess the Reb Chaim's point is that they have different purposes, different audiences, etc. Now, I don't think Rav Kafach agrees with this. Assuming that Reb Chaim is saying that the Mor Nevuchim is castor oil for the people who are confused, well, you can use arguments that aren't necessarily absolutely correct to keep them in the fold. But Rav Kafech, I don't think he would say you don't contradict that, you don't ask on the contradictions. On the contrary, for people who take the Mor Nevuchim seriously, usually the assumption is that the true view of the Rambam is found in the Mor Nevuchim. What does he then continue to say? He says that his grandfather said this, you know, that no, don't ask on the Mor Nevuchim to the Mishnah Torah, as a mufla gadol b'sefer Mor Nevuchim, sheratza lichtov alav peirush, that he was a great teacher, a great scholar in the Mor Nevuchim, and he wanted to write a peirush on it. And then he says he also wanted to write notes on the sefer Minchas Chinuch, but he didn't have time to do it. You know, Minchas Chinuch is a what is he, a Galician, right? Somehow he became an honorary Litvak, and the Minchas Chinuch is one of those books. I think Kierkegaard's another one that in his time was not considered one of the great books. That is, they weren't learning the Minchas Chinuch in the Minchas Chinuch's lifetime, and he wasn't one of the great rabbis of his day and psak and learning anything. But after the book was published and people started examining it, they began to see the genius. And 50 years later, after his death, the Minchas Chinuch is, and to this day, of course, is considered one of the classic great Svarim and one of the few Achronim that are allowed into the pantheon of Brisk. You know, Brisk, they're not into Achronim, but the Minchas Chinuch is really an exceptional, unbelievable work. It's hard to see you say that it's a commentary on the Sefer Achinuch. I mean, it's structured as a commentary on the Sefer Achinuch, but it's just a jumping off point for the Minchas Chinuch. And you find strange stuff in the Minchas Chinuch because it's not a practical work. So often he puts forth ideas that are quite unusual, but it's a work of genius. Incidentally, one other point about Reb Chaim and the Mora, I'll simply say, there was a man named Rav Avraham Dovber Levine. Actually, when he was sick, I think they added the name Chaim to him also. Who was Avraham Dovber Levine? Well, he was the founder of a group called the Malachim. He was known as the Malach. He was an extremist. He's from Chabad, by the way. And the group still exists to this day in Williamsburg. They're like the old-time Catholics. You know, the old Catholics think that beginning with Pope John the 23rd, all the popes are inauthentic. So the pope's papacy stops at John the 23rd. And these Chabadnikim, the Malachim, they think that the last authentic Chabad Rebbe was the Rebbe Rashab. And that beginning with the Friedeker Rebbe or Nachum Mendel, they're not authentic. They're fraudulent Rebbes. So he comes to America and he's the one, if you recall the story, he started influencing people in Williamsburg and elsewhere who were attending Torah Vadas. And they started wearing their tzitzis out and growing beards, doing stuff that today I think would be acceptable in yeshivas, but definitely, especially Torah Vadas, which is a chassidish yeshiva, they tell me, but definitely not in those days. In fact, there's a responsum from Rabbi Baumel, Yeshua Baumel, that's Rabbi Lamb's grandfather, Rabbi, he called himself Mister, but he was a rabbi, Shara Feivel Mendelwitz, what to do with these people, because they're creating havoc in the chaos in the yeshiva, and the yeshiva says, well, you can throw them out if they're not going to follow the rules of the yeshiva. So this man, Rabbi Levine, the Malach, when he was in Minsk, and Reb Chaim was in Minsk during World War One, he reports that he learned Mor Nevuchim together with Reb Chaim. The son, incidentally, of the, it's ironic that the son of the Malach, who was so extreme, and the people today are like Satmar, even though they come from Chabad, but the son of the Malach, he lived in Albany, New York. He attended Rites, and he shaved his beard, even though his father said you can't shave his beard. So they had an interesting relation. In fact, I read, but I only saw this in one place. I don't know if it's true that he actually taught some classes at Yeshiva University. I don't know if that's true, but his name was Zalman, Zalman Levine. Okay, let's return now to cats. We're coming not that far from the end, but we have important stuff to do. Both Sabotka, Tells, and some other interesting things. On page 258, where he repeats some things that he did before. I mean, the chapter is titled "The Dispute Within the Yeshivas," and he repeats some things, but he sums up beginning on page 258. He gives a like a summary of what was going on in the yeshivas then that would have led to the problems with Musser, because he's assuming that Musser would have been much easier accepted if it wasn't for the problems he's going to mention now. So, Nu, what about the rabbis who opposed it? It's as if he's saying that the yeshiva students, the rabbis wouldn't have had the authority, even if they opposed Mussar, but the young generation doesn't listen to the rabbis. They would listen to the Altar of Slobodka and others, not these, not, in other words, why did the yeshiva students, we understand why the Gedolim were opposed to it, but why did the yeshiva students, these are kids, 16, 17, 18, why were so many of them opposed, to Mussar, creating such controversy there? So, beginning on page, 258, he wants to put it into context here. He says, first of all, this was a time when people who were inclined to secular subjects and really to more freedoms, they didn't want to be controlled by others, as in yeshivas you would be. They couldn't go to secular schools. They couldn't go to the universities. They couldn't go to government schools. So they ended up being going to, because they wanted an academic environment. So they went to the yeshivas. So these are the sort of people already who are not going to be happy with a Mussar Seder. They want to sit and learn. That's all they want. They're there for intellectual reasons. They don't want a mashgiach looking over their shoulder, telling them what they could read and what they can't read and trying to improve their personality. That's not why they were there, and they didn't want that. And also, he points out that Haskalah was rampant in the yeshivas. It's not like today. You go to yeshiva. I mean, people have said, well, Haskalah, nothing. He goes, you go to any yeshiva today. Every one of the students there, they listen to the news. They read the newspapers. You know, these days they might not go to movies, but they have computers. So they see everything that's on TV and movie. I mean, but it's really missing the point, because that's not what Haskalah was. Haskalah was about a new Jew, creating a new personality, a new Jew. So the fact that today's, I mean, everything they're listening to, if they're watching soccer or they're football or they're doing other things, it's not, there's no ideology to creating new Jew. On the contrary, the ideology that they're looking, that they're there, that they're exposing themselves to, if they watch a movie or any, go to sporting events, this is an anti-Jewish ideology, anti-religious ideology, and they don't want to leave Judaism. So it's not a conflict. They know, today's yeshiva students, that we're here, and so they're doing something maybe the rebbes wouldn't like, but people have always done things the rebbes don't like. But that's different than Haskalah. Haskalah was about creating a new type of Jew. It was a direct challenge to the Jewish approach found in the yeshiva. And of course, you also had Zionism that was in the yeshivas. So all of these areas were influencing the students, and these were in opposition to Mussar, and they turned people into freaks. And obviously they weren't going to be interested in Mussar. And he goes on to say that the worst place is Volozhin. Okay, we've spoken about Volozhin in the past. Then he notes that the first 5 years in Russia, 1900 to 1905, those years, the first 5 years of the 20th century, were real revolutionary times, where Jews got very involved in communist organizations, and it led to the 1905 revolution and all sorts of, again, so that's all you need now, another ideology creating problems. So he elaborates on all that. He says, he mentions the yeshiva in Mulch. Now, Rav Meltzer went to this yeshiva. Rosh yeshiva was of Sender Shapiro. That yeshiva actually, I think he mentions it here, that yeshiva closed down. The Rosh yeshiva couldn't take it. I mean, you had all these students. They're all either Zionists or heretics, and Zionist heretics. They were too much trouble, and he just closed the yeshiva down. He sent them home. He's not going to have a yeshiva where the people are not taking it seriously. So why are the people there? Well, where, if they don't want to be in yeshiva, what do you mean, why are they there? That's where they were sent to. Where else are they going to go? And it's fun to be in yeshiva. You're away from home. You're 17 years old, 18 years old. You're away from home. You and your buddies, every night you get to go out to the local Jewish library. You can, you have fun. Maybe you go meet girls. You smoke. You do all sorts of things. You're living by yourself. These kids don't want to go home, but they're not, they have no business being in a yeshiva. It's not like today, in I'm thinking myself, my community, where you'd only be in a yeshiva if you wanted to. But you do have this today in the Haredi world. Don't believe me? Any night in Jerusalem, 10 o'clock, walk down the streets of Jerusalem, go into those places, the internet cafes, and you'll see, I think they call them Shababnikim, but you'll see them there watching you know, sports games, things like that. Those are people who are in yeshiva, but they shouldn't be in yeshiva, but they have to be in yeshiva because otherwise they have to go to the army. So they can't go to university or can't get a job because they'd be drafted. And their family makes them go to the yeshiva, but they have no interest in being in yeshiva. And they just, so they make the best of it. Well, that's the case that we're dealing with. So, he shut down the yeshiva, literally. And they say he mentions how the Mir yeshiva came very close to closing because of the same reason. Now, then he says, oh, that's what made the Musri yeshivas so important, because the Musri yeshivas, though, were able to stand up against the winds of Haskalah, Zionism, communism, much more successfully than the yeshivas that didn't have an ideology. It was just about learning Torah. That's a fact. I don't care any Brisker, Volozhin type. You can't deny this. And that the Musar yeshivas were much more successful because they weren't just training you in how to be a Talmud Chacham. They were training and giving you an ideology of life that could stand up. That's what he says, and I buy into it 100%. Then the next thing he moves on to is returning to Slobodka. So we've already seen Slobodka. We don't need to go. I don't know why he discusses the split of Slobodka again. We did that already, the first split. But then he gets into the second Musar controversy. So the first Musar controversy, what, 1897, I think it was, where the yeshiva actually splits. You'd think 5 years later, four years later, actually, that now you got rid of all the, I shouldn't say got rid of them, that the Musar students left the other yeshiva with the altar. Three quarters remain there. That's the figure we're given, maybe two thirds, and the rest are with the altar. So these are Musarniks. Oh. You take now the new yeshiva, Knesset Beis Yisrael, named after Rav Yisrael Salanter. You'd think that they'd be into it now, the Musar, but it's not true. Within 4 years, again, we have controversy in the yeshiva. So that's what we want to speak about now, the second Musar controversy, controversy in Slobodka. The sources of this are, one of them is Rabbi Chiya Yaakov Weinberg. Rabbi Chiya Yaakov Weinberg was there when he arrives. The Musar controversy in 1901, the second Musar controversy was in full swing. And it gets even worse than the first Musar controversy, at least in one extent. Other sources we have, there was a figure named Yisrael Dvoritz, an early Slobodka student, well, at the same time as Rabbi Chiya Yaakov Weinberg, and he wrote a whole discussion of what was going on. You have in Katz here, which I'll tell you some of what he says, and then you have this wonderful, wonderful book by Shlomo Tikhashinsky, Landanut Musar Valitism, because it's called Yeshiva Slobodka Milita L'Eretz Yisrael, but it deals with the Hebron Yeshiva, but which is Slobodka that came to Israel, but he deals so much with the Slobodka yeshiva. Really, what a great book. Incidentally, he is no longer in Israel. And on Shabbos, well, the Shabbos, I spoke about Rav Kook, and I've been speaking about Rav Kook a lot lately. So, Rav Kook, before he comes to London, he's in Switzerland, in St. Gallen, Switzerland, and he lives actually with the family named Kimchi, the Kimchi family. The Kimchi's great-grandson is J.J. Kimchi, who does the classes on Torah in Motion, the podcast, and he was actually in the shul that I was there this Shabbos. So, so the current rabbi of that town that Rav Kook was in, for about a year and a half, he was there, and it was the greatest time of his life because he had no concerns. The Kimchi family, he lived in the Kimchi's house. In fact, JJ told me that Rav Kook, as a thank you for a year or year and a half, he lived there, they fed him. He left one of his pairs of tefillin with them, and JJ's cousin wears that tefillin. And he had no concerns, no shilas, nothing. He just could sit and learn and think and write. Shlomo Tikhashinsky is now rabbi there in Switzerland, in that town. So let's talk about the second dispute, the second Musar dispute. Okay, he begins on page 264, and he tells us, Katz, he's really citing mostly from Dvoretz, that at the end of 1901, or Tafrei Samach Aleph, so that's really summer of 1901, once again there was a conflict over Mussar, and a group of students refused to be part of the Seder Mussar. What's the Seder Mussar? Let's say before Myra for a half hour, 40 minutes, whatever it is. You have to put away your svarim and learn Mussar, and then if there's a shmooze, you have to listen. They refused. You know, they refused to go along with it. So why? Why are they there? It's a very good question. Why are they there? And, you know, there's all sorts of reasons to go to yeshiva. Your parents, your father thinks it's the best place for you to go. You get money. You know, the yeshivas, they need to be supported. If they were poor people, you want to get, you have to be, give, put up in a place. And, the altar of Sabbatka accepted everyone. That was his weakness. I mentioned it already earlier with the first, dispute. His great weakness was he accepted everyone. And his even greater weakness was he refused to throw anyone out. You see what these people did? He's still the only person it seems he threw out. I shouldn't say that. There was a couple, as we'll see, real crazies he threw out, but he threw his son out. I already told you, he threw his son out. His son became a Marxist and was creating havoc in the yeshiva, he thought at least, or he wasn't a good influence. So he throws his son out, and his son ends up coming to America and never comes back to Judaism, traditional Judaism, his son. But, so he, the way Katz describes it, that he says that among the opponents of Mussar, some of the greatest students at the yeshiva were the opponents. And every day they, you know, they'd be telling, speaking and learning. So, so here you have a problem because the top students are, in the words of Katz, they're menahalim tamula neged shitat hamussar. They're leading the struggle against the Mussar. But of course, he then says that there were also students who were loyal to Mussar, and that there were great disputes. You can imagine the base medrash, the disputes going back and forth. When Dvoretz describes this, he says that these that this you had these students and other students who were not well trained, he puts it, in Mussar, and didn't understand that Mussar was the basis of the yeshiva, they were brought into the, under the guidance, as it were, of the anti-Mussar students. And he also says, Dvoretz also says that these students, these Mussar student, these anti-Mussar students, many of them had already begun to taste, Haskalah. And then he tells us, and Rabbi Chiya Weinberg mentions this also, that the it matters reached the point that they, it basically became two yeshivas. On one side of the base medrash sat the what Dvoretz calls the Baalei Machlokes, that is the opponents of Mussar, and on the other side sat the Baalei Mussar. And in fact, he says that the Baalei Mussar would call the side that the opponents of Mussar sat the Rehov HaPolani. Why? Because there was a street in Poland that was full of non-Jewish, so a street in Slobodka that was filled of non-Jewish Poles, and they would call it the Polish street. So basically they're saying that you're like Goyim, you opponents of Mussar. So this, when Rabbi Chaim Weinberg mentions that when he came to Slobodka, the yeshiva was split. They're sitting on opposite sides and have nothing to do with each other. They didn't care about the Mussar shmooze, and that's for sure the opponents. Or Moshe Mordechai Epstein, he really kept above it. I mean, Dvoretz hints that these students received some sort of like backhanded support from Moshe Mordechai Epstein, which I find hard to believe. If you recall, Moshe Mordechai leaves the yeshiva and goes with the altar to form the new yeshiva. He could have stayed. So, I mean, he is not a Mussarnik himself, but he was very close to the altars. But, look, I can see that the Moshe Mordechai maybe he still wanted to keep these students because, after all, they were Iluyim. They were great Torah scholars, even if they were opposed to Mussar. So they would go to the Shiurim of Moshe Mordechai, but wanted nothing to do with anything else. Okay, so what I need to do, well, I see already it's 9:25, so I'll take the questions, is I want to tell you the story of the second dispute. And the second dispute, it gets... to show you how bad things get, and we know things can get bad. I've showed you in the past videos of Ponevesh. It's funny that as we speak, it's split into two yeshivas. I showed you videos. You can see it on YouTube of fights that broke out, picking up chairs and throwing at each other, momish fights. You had a little of that in Slabodka, as we'll see. Unfortunately, some guy, some idiot, assumed that since we're opposed to Musar people, we can disgrace the Musar books. And, you know, but which is unheard of, because even the opponents of Musar understood that Musar books were holy books. So we'll finish up with that, and then we have to move on to Tells. And wait till you hear this. For Tells itself is such a fascinating place. But the Machlokes in Tells, what a Machlokes. And wait till you see who led the Machlokes. And that really will bring us to the end of the Musar dispute in the yeshivas. And then we're going to move on in the maybe one or two more classes after that to look at two great figures. One is Rav Kook, what he has approached to Musar is, and then the Chazon Ish. Because there's interesting things to say about the Chazon Ish. So let me see the questions here. Hold on a second. I want to pull something up to show you. Hold on. Let me see. Okay. Where are we? Okay, questions, comments. Let's see. Something in this article which Joy in Sfarad and Ashkenaz. You know, I don't subscribe. I have access to Mosaic, but I have to log in, so I didn't see it. MJ Frankel, the story of Malachim is well told in Mintz's book, Hasidic People. Yes, and as Mintz points out, if people today won't remember it, many of them, but in the 70s, when you had these battles with Chabad and Lubavitch, they even hung the Lubavitch Rebbe in effigy once, terrible disputes. Apparently, it was not the Satmar that were responsible for the hanging the Rebbe in effigy. It was the Malachim. And the Malachim, as coming from Chabad, would have stronger feelings towards mainstream Lubavitcher. So if you don't know this book by Mintz, Hasidic People, that has, it's all about Hasidic, he has informants in which he calls them by like their first name. Quite interesting. And in that book, I mentioned it this summer on one of the buses, the story of Chich, of the girl who, the virgin who gave birth. And what is it? I don't know. No, it wasn't a virgin, but she claimed that she was impregnated by the demon. I mentioned this before, and where the Sprecher article on that. And to this day, there's people who won't marry into that family, even though the Satmar Rebbe said it's not a problem. So Mintz has the whole story there of Chich as it continues today into the 20th century. Well, you asked, do I recall which specific issue the Malach had with the previous Lubavitch Rebbe? They thought they were modernizers, compromisers. They accepted the state of Israel. That was the issue. Someone asked about the new book on Rav Kook. The new book on Rav Kook is on ideas which we see in him, particularly in the newly published writings, the writings that were suppressed. I think some people are going to not like the book because they think it's maybe it portrays him, some of his ideas, as too out of the mainstream. But it's on new, mostly, not all, but much of it on new ideas from the writings that came out in the last 20 years, by chapters on his view of other religions and the role of halacha. Because for Rav Kook, you know, there reaches a point where maybe the tzaddik can move beyond halacha in theory, not in practice, but in theory. So what does that say? So there's a lot of interesting things. Dov, thank you very much. Let's be in touch afterwards. Frankel says, I think it's typically the origin, not with the last Lubavitch Rebbe, but his father. Yes, well, the Malach was apparently his tutor, and there are conflicting stories where the sixth Rebbe misbehaved as a student, and then the Malach ratted him out to the fifth or the Lubavitch version. No, but the thing is, it's the father-in-law. Yeah, it's the Friedrich Rebbe, Rav Yosef Yitzchak. That's where, in the Malachim's understanding, the movement goes off. And is not follow. They consider themselves Chabad, It's just that the movement is incorrect. No, it's the father, it would be the Rashab. The Rashab is kosher for them. Then it's the Rav Yosef Yitzchak, the son, he's a problem, and then his son-in-law is Rav Nachum Mendel. Gershon says the dying Yecheskel Abramsky had any communication with the altar of Slobodka. They both had sons who were Marxists, but the dying never rejected his son Shimon, world famous Yiddish professor. By the way, there's another Marxist I'll tell you about next class, who also comes out of the yeshiva and has a very important role in American labor history. And he was involved with the Roosevelt administration. I'm not going to give it away, but we'll get to it on next class. So there's a bunch of, and he began as a Marxist also, this one, but then he became a New Deal type. As far as I know, there wasn't any connection between Diane Abramsky and the altar, other than just the sort of thing that they all had. They raised money. Remember, Diane Abramsky becomes Rav in Slutsk, but the yeshiva wasn't there. Yes, Rav Abramsky had a son, Shimon, who became a Marxist. In fact, Shimon's grand is it his, his grandson wrote a very interesting book about his grandfather. In fact, I believe Shimon Abramsky was banned by the British government from Palestine because of his mark. I think he was expelled and not allowed to come. But there was another son Diane Abramsky had, who was much more important, really, I think. His name was Yaakov, a Hebrew writer in the world of like Hebrew writing. He was also not religious, at least as judging from the pictures I see of him. Maybe I shouldn't judge, but they say he wasn't religious at all. I can't testify to that. Like Shimon Abramsky was a communist, but they supposedly he wasn't religious at all. But again, I don't know. Maybe he's just one of these people. He still kept kosher. I shouldn't say. I can't say. But he definitely was not the following in the path of Rav Yecheskel Abramsky. And he has another son who was still religious. I think Menachem is his name or something. He's the one who publishes the Sfarim. But of course, in the like in the Haredi world, there's a reason for this, they say, because the time, what was it, 2 years or something, there Yecheskel Abramsky was in Siberia then when he was arrested and sent away, that during that time there wasn't a fatherly figure, so they were influenced in a bad way. But look, I can go down the list of Gedolei Yisrael who were in the house, and their children also came out as communists. So, I mean, living in the Soviet Union, that's where they were. I mean, it's a little hard to raise your children properly. We did classes on the Abramsky. Yes, so Shimon was a Jewish, and he never he was at the university, but as far as I know, he never had a PhD. And but he was a great he wrote some very interesting things. And but I think his other son, Yaakov David Abramsky, obviously named after Yaakov David Wolofsky, the great Ritbaz and a predecessor of Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky as Rav in Slutsk. And yes, someone privately gave it away. They know the Marxist who was in the so I'll say it because we'll get to the next class. Sidney Hillman. If you don't know Sidney Hillman, he's not the son, he's a son of not the son of Rabbi Hillman, the father-in-law of Rav Herzog, the son of another Rabbi Hillman, who's a rabbi of the city Zager. We mentioned that. So I will get to Sidney Hillman next class. And I'll tell you a little bit more about him as well. So he was an Eloi, they say. Okay, thank you all for coming out tonight, Rabbi Kelman.
I spent
And
5 minutes
thank you. I'm going to
looking.
give credit, hold on, to Moshe from Lakewood, who knew Sidney Hillman. Okay, yes.
Well, I was looking for the Misman book. I know I had it at one point. I read it many years ago, and I haven't seen it in my, books for a long time. So I spent a few minutes looking. I can't find it. I probably lent it to somebody and I forgot.
You're
But
like everyone. You have too many books and they get lost, and you'll find it one
right.
day going for something
Right.
else. We all have
As I
that
learned.
problem.
Anyways, but yes, the Shlomi Maisel is like I would understand that her son would not want it republished. Let's put it that way. You are. Anyways, tomorrow Marty Lakshin continue really a very interesting for those who were there last week on Slichot, Sephardic Slichot, Ashkenazic Slichot, the difference, the moods. Anyway, so that's tomorrow at 11 a.m. and then Rabbi Shulman at 1 p.m. So doubleheader tomorrow. And okay, look forward to learning with you and invite a friend. If you haven't registered yet for our Rosh Hashanah Yom Iyun, please do so before Sunday, because it requires a different registration link than, you know, all our other classes. That's 6 speakers Sunday, 9:15 to 1:30 we'll be having. I'm here actually at Rav Stav. I don't know how many people know Rav Stav, Rav David Stav, who should have been the chief rabbi of Israel, but that's a whole other story. And the Rav of Shoham, really the founder of Tzohar. So I'm very, he speaks a nice English. I mean, I told him one day when he read, he will be talking in English. He'll be one of the speakers, and Rabbi Drach, of course, who now lives in Israel, and have a, I think, a good program. So we look forward to learning with you and all our regular classes during the week. And everybody be well. We should hear good news. And pretty insane what's going on in the world. Everywhere you look and turn, I don't know what to say. But all right, we should be blessed with a better year. What can I say? And okay, Laila Tov, everybody. Yes. Thank you.
Tuda rabba.
Levakasha. Be well. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.